This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Yeah, this is The God Show, and we're going to be talking about a lot of Washingtoning and things. And some of you right now in this country and in other countries may be asking instantly, why would you even think that God knows where Washington is or care? No matter who's in what office, there's always that question of moral decision-making, ethics, all of those things. And sometimes we're disappointed, even in the ones that we send there. Well, in this case, we're going to be talking about morality and the law on the highest plane, the Supreme Court. And when you do that, you got to find the right person who maybe has some experience, not necessarily pleading the law or cases before the Supreme Court, but experience like being a graduate of Notre Dame undergrad and having a lot of moral decisions that he's had to make in the practice of law, very successful practice. Patrick McGroder practiced law in Phoenix now for more than 40 years. He specializes in catastrophic personal injury and wrongful death. He's a graduate of the University of Notre Dame and the University of Arizona College of Law. And boy, his credits don't stop. He's a fellow of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers and was the Academy's president a few years ago. He's been selected as one of the 10 best lawyers in Arizona by the Arizona Business Journal. And since 2008, he's been selected by Law Dragon as one of the 500 best lawyers in America. With those kinds of credentials, he finally reaches the peak of his career by being on The God Show. Patrick McGroder, it's good to have you with us once again. And I would love to know something I've never asked you in the shows that we've done. Is being selected to be on the United States Supreme Court, is that the pinnacle of every lawyer's career aspirations?
No, Pat. In my opinion, it's not. You know, we as lawyers are disparate in terms of knowledge base, in terms of acumen, in terms of articulation, in terms of interests. So there are many lawyers that would agree that the pinnacle of anyone's career would be selected to be on the Supreme Court, and closely thereafter arguing a case in the United States Supreme Court. Now, my career path was not in that vein. My career path took a different trek. But certainly there are people that would say that is an honor beyond all honors to be named a justice of the United States Supreme Court.
But regardless of the honor that surrounds that invitation, that nomination, that consideration, is it a matter of saying, you know what, that isn't what I want to do? Did you actually make that decision and say, no, my interests are over in this arena over here, has nothing to do with that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely, Pat. And you could say that about any judgeship, whether it's a municipal judgeship, a trial court position, or an appellate court decision. You know, it's a career choice. And not that you can deem that you're going to be a judge. For example, here in Arizona, our judges, for the most part, are selected by a merit system. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court is a political appointment. At least it's turned into a partisan political appointment. which is part of, I think, the shame of what's been going on for the last 5 or 10 years. You know, in many circles, the idea of being a judge at whatever level, from municipal to the U.S. Supreme Court, is an honor, and it should be an honor. And it should reflect the best and the brightest, but more importantly, those people that have empathy and compassion and clearly understand people's problems and are willing to sacrifice their legal career to become a judicial officer so they can help solve problems, not make problems. And in my mind, of course, I deal with trial judges. You know, very rarely do I deal with appellate judges. I have, of course, in my career. I've not had the honor of appearing before the United States Supreme Court, but that doesn't reflect my own feelings about the success or lack thereof of my career. There are many lawyers who have argued from Arizona before the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's clearly a badge of not only honor, but also of accomplishment. But my career has not taken me in that direction, nor do I consider it to be a lack of success for not having done so.
When was a Supreme Court nomination not political?
Well, I think, Pat, probably never, but never in the sense that it has become a partisan endeavor as it has been probably since the nomination of Robert Bork, and mm-hmm. it has continued to some degree since that time, but never so more partisan than I think the Kavanaugh hearings and perhaps the hearings that are upcoming with Judge Barrett. The Clarence Thomas hearings, were they partisan? I would categorize them more of a delving into someone's background of obviously claims of untoward behavior, primarily sexual behavior, that kind of pervaded the Kavanaugh hearings as well. But I think Thomas was probably the first nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court that underwent such personal scrutiny, given the allegations that were made by Anita Hill.
No matter which side you were on, that was embarrassing to watch.
Well, it is embarrassing, and it's reflective of the absolute division in this country. And if you look at, and I'm certainly not taking sides, but even if you look at our local senatorial race now between Kelly and McSally, what do you see? You see the constant of negative advertising. You don't see a candidate standing up and saying, look, you know, here's what I stand for. Here's what I've done throughout my life. Here's what I've done as a U.S. senator, or here's what I've done in business, or here's how I have affected the human condition by the decisions that I have made. And looking prospectively, this is what I intend to do if I'm so honored to be your United States senator. I am so sick and tired of listening to and watching negative advertising as it relates to the political fray. It's disgusting, at least in my opinion.
And sad also that virtually everybody is left consciously or unconsciously with a negative attitude toward everybody that they're watching described on television. You're really left with the idea that, wow, if that's true, I don't know that I like either one of these people. But let's talk about contributions professionally. I want people to get to know you a little bit better, too. You have been involved with so many extraordinarily interesting and dramatic cases. I'd like to know, and I've never asked you this before, I'd like to know if you could just choose right now The three you're proudest of, immediate recall.
Well, number one would be our work representing fallen police officers that burned alive in Ford Crown Victoria police interceptors. There were at least 18 of those cases involving death. There were only two survivors. One, of course, is our favorite police officer in Arizona, and that's Jason Schechterly, who was fortunate enough to survive. But what we're most proud about is not only achieving justice for Jason and all of those families that lost loved ones in otherwise survivable crashes, but that Ford fixed 350,000 police cars. And we're very proud of that. And we think we've made the world a little safer for police officers. Probably number two, and probably an arcane case that people might not remember. We were honored to represent the family of the pilot and the photojournalist from Channel 3 that was involved in the horrific helicopter crash over downtown Phoenix some years ago with the Channel 10 helicopter. And again, we were pleased to achieve justice for the family. But equally importantly, we were able to effectuate change in the sense that pool helicopters disappeared from the skies in Arizona. And now what you see in all channels is feeds from one helicopter as opposed to the five or six that were hovering, chasing a stolen City of Phoenix water truck, which was absurd. Probably number three would be I was co-legal counsel in the Telluride bus crash involving seven Arizonans that died and another 43 that were seriously injured. We were fortunate enough to not only, again, achieve justice for the families, but we were able to argue for the adoption of the, I think it was 2016 Motor Coach Bus Act, a federal act, that ensured that all new buses would be equipped with seatbelts. Ironically, in the case involving the Telluride bus crash, 50 were dead or injured, one was not, and that was the bus driver who was seatbelted. And then, not to bore you, Pat, but a quick third would be the honor that we had to represent the widows and families of the Granite Mountain hotshots.
Thank you.
Which resulted in a number of remedial measures adopted willingly by our state forester. And many of those remedial measures that we insisted on are in place now and hopefully have saved lives of wildland firefighters. So didn't mean to bore you with that list, but we're pretty proud of the work we did. And not only representing the family, but making sure that these types of problems would not cause calamity, injury, or death to others.
That has nothing to do with vanity and boredom. It's a way of introducing my guest with very specific arenas that you have to remember out of the headlines. Every single one of those is remembered dramatically, not the least of which, of course, by the families involved. But those were stories that also did a great deal, I think, for the practice of law, because you can't delve into the details of those and the results and continue to think of all accident lawyers as being accident or as being ambulance chasers. And that's one of those phrases that is still used by so many people every time that they see someone talking about practicing accident law. Isn't that true?
Well, that is true. And, you know, I have the honor and the privilege of having my son now work with me as a fellow trial lawyer. And I think, Pat, that in those phrases, ambulance chasers and accident or injury lawyers, The forgotten term is a trial lawyer. I mean, I am a trial lawyer. I've represented Bishop O'Brien, as you well know. I've done criminal work, I've done civil work, I've done commercial civil work. But yes, is the bulk of my practice representing victims of calamity and adversity? Absolutely. But we're trial lawyers, and we understand that the ultimate arbiter in any case involving injury or death is a jury. And so we prepare our cases as if these cases may eventually wind up in front of a jury. So are we trial lawyers? Absolutely. Are we trial lawyers that specialize in catastrophic and wrongful death cases? Absolutely. And it's too bad that for whatever reason, the monikers like ambulance chasers, et cetera, seem to resonate with so many people. And the term trial lawyer historically has meant something other than what I believe it represents, and that is the ultimate advocate for victims.
And most of the time, the only time that we see trial lawyers practicing are actors playing trial lawyers on television series or movies. We've got Patrick McGroder. He's a real-life trial lawyer, happens to practice with Buse Gilbert McGroder Law Firm, and he's on The God Show to talk about areas of moral decision-making and ethical decision-making that we're going to get to in just a moment. I will tell you, if my enthusiasm sounds at an unusual level for this particular guest, it's because I admire him for a couple of things. One is he chose to go to undergraduate school where my son went, and that is Notre Dame. And I don't care whether you're a taxi driver in the Bronx or you're a farmer in Iowa, if you have any relationship at all with that kind of history, with that kind of tradition, or with Ireland, you automatically know exactly what I'm feeling when I use that phrase, just Notre Dame, and you hear that fight song. But I like Patrick because he was smart enough to say, this is a terrific school, fantastic experience that I've had here, but it is the coldest damn place I've ever been in my entire life, South Bend, Indiana. Where can I go for just a little warmth? And where did you decide, Pat?
University of Arizona, Tucson, Arizona.
Bear down.
Bear down, baby.
Well, we're talking about your practice of law, and we're talking about it on the highest possible level, at least in the recognition of decisions that affect the nation and the world. As you've studied law and you've practiced law, do you have a favorite justice in the history of the Supreme Court?
Probably Thurgood Marshall.
Why?
I'd say why, because of his background, where he came from, the generation that he lived in, and the enormity of the obstacles that he overcame to become a lawyer, to become a justice of the Supreme Court, and the courage to change the social fabric in the United States using the Constitution. We hear so much today about, quotes, conservative judges, end of quotes, or that this judge has to be a strict constitutionalist judge. And Trump, of course, is so proud of all the federal judges that he's appointed, and he labels them as strict constructionists. Well, I don't buy that. I think that for example, a Supreme Court judge is deciding a case, of course is his Bible the U.S. Constitution. But the U.S. Constitution is 200 or 300 years old. The founders of our country didn't anticipate abortion. They didn't anticipate mass shootings. They didn't anticipate the type of social issues that have come and will continue to come before the Supreme Court. So is the bedrock the United States Constitution? Absolutely. No question about that. But it has to have a malleable voice, and it has to be interpreted in a way not to degrade values and not to degrade the mores of this country, but it has to look at a contemporary constructionist look at the problems that we're facing today. There weren't environmental issues in 1776. There weren't the type of issues that have emerged that unfortunately have now relegated to partisan issues. So I think a judge, and I'll talk about Judge Barrett if you'd like me to, but a judge, especially at the Supreme Court level, and that's why I admired Thurgood Marshall. He captured the sense of the Constitution and how it was being permutated by Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. And he took that apart just like he should have taken it apart, because that's not what the Constitution stood for, and that's not what this country stood for. That's why I love Thurgood Marshall.
In just a few minutes, I do want to talk about the new nominee, but let's get back to the Constitution itself. Don't you think it's a disservice to the creators of the Constitution and all that it has meant to this country in so many ways to consider it, for any individual justice to consider the Constitution of the United States as being a conservative piece of justice, a liberal constitution, conservative constitution? Is it really either, or should it not be labeled as either?
When you're considering the rights of American citizens in whatever form, in whatever fashion those rights are, is there really a conservative view? Is there really a liberal view? Or is it not to make those rights sacrosanct, but also put those rights in the context of what is going on contemporarily, and rather than say blindly, well, the fathers of the Constitution in 1776 meant this or meant that, when those folks could not have even conceived, let alone imagined, the type of issues, social issues, that are now coming before the United States Supreme Court in the context of trying to slot them in some type of constitutional fashion. Is it right to try? Sure. But the fact that they don't exactly fit the cookie cutter model, does that mean somehow, some way, that there has to be a conservative or liberal bent? I personally don't think so, when you're dealing with the rights of human beings. That's my personal view.
Amy Coney Barrett, the newest nominee that will be vetted over the next several days, is a graduate of Notre Dame. Apparently, and I always hate these judgments to be made by media in general, when you say a very, very staunch Catholic. Well, that's a very private kind of determination. But let's just say she's certainly active in the church that you and I both are part of. But is she also what a number of other people label her, and that is an originalist? What does that mean?
You know, I did some reading in preparation for our visit here today, and I still am struggling with that definition. I've looked at her background, which is stellar, educationally, familially, experientially. She's stellar. Okay, she's stellar. And so the idea somehow, some way, that we can prejudge how she will rule on what seem to be the hot button issues that I'm hearing, A, abortion, B, gun rights. Well, I'm not so sure looking back in her past and the record that she has amassed. She's been part of about 900 appellate court decisions. She never sat on a trial bench, so she never heard jury trials. I don't think she ever tried anything in private practice. So she is one that is coming out of academia. She is one that is coming out of a background of enormous legal research and writing, as opposed to other judges potentially that have come from being a street lawyer or a prosecutor or a trial lawyer up through the Superior Court branch and up through the appellate courts, whether it be state or federal. So the idea that she is an originalist, I guess, has some implication as it applies to these partisan conservative issues. But I'm not ready to judge her yet, and I certainly can't form any judgments about her based on what she herself has said vis-a-vis the Affordable Care Act or abortion or gun rights. So I understand the partisan concerns. They obviously have spilled over viscerally from the Kavanaugh hearings. But I'm not ready to label her, and I'm not so sure she is labeled herself, either by her words or her decisions.
I know that you've met a number of people who are faculty members at Notre Dame in different fields, but most particularly Notre Dame Law School, even though you didn't go there. I know you know some of those folks. Have you ever met Amy Coney Barrett?
I have never met her, but I was when I heard she was in the running, of course, I immediately did a little research on her. And the thing that struck me and would probably strike somebody like you, Patty, is the fact that this woman, as successful as she is the mother of seven children, two of which she adopted from Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, as a trial lawyer, or as some might call me, an ambulance chaser, that strikes me in the heart, it strikes me in the soul, and it suggests to me that the type of person that this woman is really has empathy and compassion to have seven kids, two of which are adopted. This is not an inherently bad person.
Tell me, though, about the inherent struggle that must exist, and we have to keep in mind that there are other Catholics that are a part of the Supreme Court. We're not talking about her representing Catholicism uniquely and exclusively in that august body. But when someone is on the Supreme Court of the United States and issues like abortion, Roe versus Wade, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, when those are presented to you and you morally feel an obligation to abide by the very, very strict black and white rulings of your church, how do you set that aside and just be a justice and not a Catholic justice?
I'll answer that in two fashions. There has been occasions in the course of my career, and I know my son's career as well, where we have been asked to represent people, either directly or in furtherance of causes, that were in opposite to Catholic dogma. Now, the fact that I am a lawyer and licensed to uphold the ethical mandates of my profession, that does not skew my personal feelings as a practicing Catholic. But having said that, my job is to represent the people that have come to me for help. It's not my job to judge them. It's not my job to impose Catholic dogma on these folks as it might relate to issues that are tangentially related to Catholic dogma. But I would hearken to Barrett's own words. And she said, quotes, "If you're asking whether I take my faith seriously, and I'm a faithful Catholic, I am. Although I would stress that my personal church affiliation or my religious belief would not bear in the discharge of my duties as a judge." Now, those are words to live by, and those are words, excuse the pun, to judge by. Now, if she believes that, which I don't know her, but this is a quote, then I would not be fearful that somehow Judge Barrett would impose her own feelings about Catholic dogma in terms of making decisions, whether it be the Affordable Care Act, whether it be gun control, or whether it be abortion. So does that mean I support her, or does that mean I support the way her nomination has been put forth? Absolutely not. I think the way this has been handled by the Republican Party again speaks to the lack of commitment and dignity that the United States Congress should show. Do I have a major problem with Judge Barrett? No, I mean, I'd like to hear what she has to say, obviously. But in terms of what I've read about her and her own words in talking about those issues that people seem to be partisan about, so far, she's doing good by me.
Was Ruth Bader Ginsburg as powerful a force as she has been presented to us after her passing?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg was on the vanguard of social and gender equality from the day she was born. It was a mission. It was a calling. She came from a generation where there weren't a lot of female lawyers, let alone female appellate lawyers. She understood the power of the gender bias in the law, whether it was spoken or unspoken. And she, above all women, in my humble judgment, broke the glass pane. She was committed to social change. She was committed to gender change. She was committed to the equality of women, in part, Pat, because of her generation and how she was raised through the legal profession. This woman is an American hero, as great American hero as you can imagine, because what she has done, and it should have been done a long time ago, and Susan B. Anthony would be cheering her, and that is to ensure that women have equality everywhere, just not in the home, everywhere. You know, she was great.
Pat, as we were talking over the last few minutes about moral decision-making, active participation in one's church, and I reflected back on that time in 1960, 59 and 60, when there was a very, very strong movement about keeping that Catholic Jack Kennedy out of the White House. Yeah, no, it isn't the judiciary, but it's a pretty powerful position, keeping him out of the White House. And I remember seeing the news stories in the newspaper and on television about deep concern in some pockets of America that the power of the White House would be moved to Rome and the Vatican. Remember that?
Pat, I was in high school in 1959. Maybe I was still in grammar school. And the idea that the United States presidency would be subservient to the papacy was rampant in the South and in the halls of Congress. And it was beyond belief. And, of course, we were big supporters of Kennedy for a variety of reasons. My dad was secretary of the New York State Electoral College that elected John F. Kennedy. And John F. Kennedy took it on. And he was a great example, Pat, and I'm glad you raised that, a great example of not making his faith subservient to his politics, but making it coexistent. In other words, he was going to do what was best for the United States, and in his private life, he continued to be a Catholic, and whether he was a good Catholic or bad, of course, history will have to tell us that. But that's a great example that you raised. And I think Barrett is going to be the same type of person. Now, to digress, whether or not she has the power and whether or not she has the foresight and the vision of Justice Ginsburg remains to be seen.
Very few have.
Very few have, my friend.
By the way, it seems to me also a kind of personal annoyance out of the practice of law that the United States in general and all legal forces are gratified that I didn't choose as a career field. But outside of the practice of law, there seems to be this rubber stamp kind of thing. We've been talking about that. But it has been applicable to choosing justices of the Supreme Court ever since I can remember. It's always been the concern that this person is too conservative to be able to make legal and just decisions while on the court. Too liberal, perhaps, to be able to do that. And yet it seems over the years, as I have followed the practices of these justices, it's almost impossible to determine what their decisions are going to be in advance, because there's so much flexibility of so many of the justices once they arrive at that position on the Supreme Court. So many surprises, are there not, Pat, with conservatives joining the liberals, liberals joining the conservatives, and you just never seem to know one judgment from the next.
If you look at Chief Justices Berger, Rehnquist, and now Roberts, all purportedly passed the litmus test of conservative jurists, each of them, in their own way, raised their own game to the level of ensuring that not only the United States Constitution was upheld, but melded their decisions commensurate with contemporary issues. And each of those, quotes, conservative judges have come forward to join what people refer to as liberal judges or conservative judges in making the right decisions. If you look at the history of the United States Supreme Court, between the presidency and the United States Supreme Court, those two American institutions have shaped this country. Those two institutions, for the most part, have shaped who we are, what we are, and have created American history in the most positive of ways, in my humble judgment.
You know, a lot of attorneys that have gone to Catholic law school, Notre Dame, Georgetown, if you had gone to a Catholic law school, do you think that the moral issues that face all of us would have been taught differently by the faculty members?
I don't think in recent vintage, because for the most part, Pat, in Catholic law schools, you're not going to find any Catholic instructors or any faculty members. And by that, I mean clerics. I don't mean people that are practice Catholicism. I'm talking about clerics.
Yeah, people
you're not
of the
find
faith.
Priests
right.
teaching torts and property and things of that nature. No, I think, Pat, for the most part, Catholic universities that have a law school as part of the university, those law schools generally operate separately, different structures. The dean is much more powerful, and the denomination that you find in Catholic law schools, I think, is very, very diverse. Very diverse.
You mentioned a while back that in your practice as a trial lawyer, that no matter how successful you've been, there have been times when you had to set aside your religious beliefs in representing a particular client for that reason, for whatever the reason was that you had to do that. Do you find now, after all these years of practicing law, that attorneys sometimes have to choose between a client and their personal sense of morality?
I see it more and more. And again, it's generally, Pat, in the... my Buffalo accent just came out. Pat. I generally see it, Patty, on the criminal side of the ledger. Now, my son, of course, was a public defender for a number of years, and of course, they can't choose their clients. But private practitioners have the ability to elect or not to elect to represent someone, and there are touchy moral issues, especially on the criminal side, when you're dealing with folks that are charged with alcohol or drug-related offenses, child molesting, sexual assaults. A lot of those issues strike hard and deep in the moral conscience of lawyers. I mean, look, we're human beings first and we're lawyers second. And so I would see that primarily on the criminal side. I mean, you're probably not going to see a lot of moral issues regarding wills and trusts or landlord disputes or auto accidents or those types of things. I don't think you're going to see a lot of morality there. I have had in my practice, as it relates to that, though, I have had people tell me that they're not going to tell the truth. And, of course, that is a very, very bright line ethically in our profession.
What do you do? What do you do?
Oh, I've shown them the door. I've shown them the door. I'm not interested in people that are frauds or liars or cheats or in anyone that's not seeking justice for a legitimate reason. We don't have patience for those kind of people.
But in your son's practice as a public defender, and he's assigned to defend someone that for every good, solid reason he believes is guilty of the crime that he's accused of, does he also have a responsibility to share that with his father confessor?
Here's why I love my son so much. My son is as ethical and as good a trial lawyer as I know. And if Patty, and I call him Patty, if Patty stepped over that ethical line and said to himself, my client is guilty, therefore, he will, I am not going to ensure that my client is entitled to every right that he has under the United States Constitution, then not only has Pat violated his oath, he's violated his ethics, and he's violated his duty to his client. His job is not to judge. No public defender's job is to judge. A public defender or a criminal defense lawyer's job is to ensure that his or her client is entitled to every right that any citizen under our system of justice and our Constitution is entitled to. Once a lawyer steps over that line, then he becomes the jury. Then he or she becomes the judge. And then the system is skewed. Then the Constitution doesn't work. And then the rights of the accused are violated and deviated from. And that's what most people don't understand. I've got that question 1,000 times. How can you represent somebody that you know is guilty or you believe is guilty? That's not my job. You might not like my job. You might not agree that's part of my job. But my job is to ensure that client has the benefit of his or her constitutional rights. That is my primary job.
See, that's an example, I say to our audience, why it is that I wanted Patrick McGroeder on, because we're talking about all of those moral and ethical issues you probably wouldn't necessarily ask Patrick or his son or any other attorney at a cocktail party. But you've wanted to know, and you also want to know these days about the makeup of the Supreme Court. It's a headline story. Pat McGroeder, who practices as a partner with Buse, Gilbert, and McGroeder. And getting back to the Supreme Court, what future decisions concern you, Pat? We've talked about Roe versus Wade abortion. We've talked about gun rights. We've talked about Obamacare, for lack of a better term. Are those highest on your priority list, or are there others?
Well, you know, it's funny, Pat, I'm a moderate, but when it comes to the rights of human beings, I am absolutely unidimensional. So the issues that concern me at this point in time is the extension of the Affordable Care Act. The reason being is that I see people that are broken every day. I see quadriplegics, paraplegics, amputees, traumatic brain injury patients, burn patients, all that move forward in life with pre-existing conditions. We need to have a system. Is the Affordable Care Act perfect? No. Is it a system that's made a giant step in ensuring that people in this country have access to health care? Absolutely. I'm concerned about gun control and not necessarily gun rights in the sense that the Second Amenders always argue. I'm concerned about mass shootings. I'm concerned about the death of young children. I'm concerned about guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have guns and how we can, understanding the Constitution and the Second Amendment, we can eliminate or at least curtail the ability of these nutcases to have weapons that kill our citizens needlessly and recklessly. I'm very, very concerned about that. I'm concerned about this fallacy of what people call tort reform, which is an absolute, it's a non sequitur.
Explain it.
The only
explain it to the people who have no idea what that means.
Yeah. Curtail victims' rights by caps on judgment, by violating the ability of victims to seek civil recourse in whatever fashion possible, to limit exposure to corporations and to professionals that not intentionally, but hurt people negligently or gross negligently or whatever the case may be. They hurt people. And the idea that somehow, some way, our legislature knows more or better than our jury systems is an affront to our justice system. The only real tort reform is our jury system. And juries, after 45 years of practicing as a trial lawyer, juries get it right. They don't always get it right, but for the most part, they get it right, and they try and do the right thing. And that's the tort reform, if you want to even call that word. And I hate that word because it makes no sense. So there should be no curtailing in any way, in any fashion, and anyone's ability to get full and complete justice without a discount if they desire to move forward with any type of case.
I had absolutely no idea that I was going to ask you this, but just simply the remote possibility that you would have a general figure in mind. Do you happen to remember what Jason Schechterle's total medical costs were, the burn victim that we were referring to before that you represented in the Ford cop case?
The only reason I can tell you that it is a matter of public record in the case, and his medical bills and expenses were in the millions, not thousands, in the millions.
How were they paid for?
Well, twofold. Number one, because he was in the course and scope of his employment, he had workman's compensation, but that paid a portion of his bills. On top of that, of course, and I don't want to get into too specifics in terms of balance billing and hospital billing and insurance billing and things of that nature, but there were monies over and above that, that twofold, Jason owed. And, of course, the workman's compensation system afforded the city of Phoenix, who was the workman's comp in his case, the ability to lien his settlement to the extent they paid Jason's medical bills and lost wages. So we had to deal with a plethora of issues regarding liens and workman's comp and payback and things of that nature. But moving forward, Jason had a series of pre-existing conditions, obviously. And so, thank God, Jason was lucky enough to have workman's compensation insurance, but he was lucky. There's so many victims that I've represented and so many people you know that come down with the most horrific of diseases who don't have insurance, or didn't before the Affordable Care Act, or have a series of pre-existing injuries, whether it's high blood pressure to diabetes to lupus to whatever the case may be, who prior to the Affordable Care Act were labeled as, wait a minute, this is a pre-existing condition. We can't pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because of the Affordable Care Act, and I'm not suggesting it doesn't need to be changed, altered, modified to make it better. I think it can be made better. But at least these folks with pre-existing conditions now at least can go to bed at night knowing that tomorrow, if they need a doctor, they can call them and it'll be paid for.
And that's one of the reasons that I asked you, because of the dramatic nature of Jason Schechterle's case, but with so many other people whose cases are just as dramatic because they have them. I have a minute and a half left. Should we change the Supreme Court?
No. You mean to add additional Supreme Court justices?
Yeah. Yes, and also the amount of time that they serve.
Well, that's a two-part question. I'd answer the first question in the negative. No, we should not stack the court. FDR tried to do that, was not successful. The Supreme Court has been a fabulous institution for the United States. As far as term limits, that's another subject, Pat, I'd like to be heard on. I've got a lot of positions and a lot of offices that ought to be term limited, in my humble judgment. Supreme Court, you know, Pat, that's a great question, and I haven't really thought about it. Obviously, there's been instances where the health and perhaps the physical and mental status of a Supreme Court judge is at issue. But I really don't have an opinion on that. I'd have to think about that, Patty.
Boy, am I glad I asked you at the end of the show.
Well, you always ask me something I don't know the answer to.
Patrick McGroder, he's a trial attorney, Buse Gilbert McGroder, and I'm proud once again to have said he's our guest on The Gone Show.